Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, every family has its secrets. Alcoholism, abuse, family hatred, sexual preferences, mental illness, disloyalty. And oftentimes these secrets that families hold within themselves bring a lot of pain and agony. And there's a new memoir called Lifeguarding, a memoir of secret swimming and the South, written by Catherine McCall, who is a physician and psychiatrist in Wilmington, North Carolina, and she's come up to Chapel Hill to promote her book and talk to us about it. Catherine, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, DG. It's great being here.
I hope I can call you Catherine.
Of course, absolutely.
Well, this is is it fair to say that it's an unusually interesting book? It's both a memoir of family and a very introspective look at yourself that you've written. I mean, I think that's fair.
It's both those things, which, and maybe a way to describe that is how we become the individuals that we are through growing up in a family or in a group. So in other words, we were so tight as a family, and we'll get into that, I'm sure, that there wasn't a lot of room for individual difference. And yet, we all navigate that to a greater or lesser degree, or hopefully we do as we grow up. And so this book is about both my family and my story within that family story.
Well, tell us, just kind of give us the background of your family, mama, daddy, children.
Right. My mom and dad, and I have an older sister, Anne, and a younger brother, Kurt. They're 2.5 years apart, each of us. And pretty much that's it. It's the five of us.
You're growing up in Louisville.
Grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. I was born and bred there, and we did have my parents and my father's only sibling died before I knew them, before I was born. So there were ghosts in our family as well. The presence of their memories and of their lives, except they weren't actually there. It's kind of hard to explain.
You talk about the ghost in your book, and these were family members, both your parents' siblings and your parents' parents became ghosts in the house as well.
Yes.
And, how is it? I mean, all of us have our deceased family members, but what you emphasize this was something special.
Well, it was actually very traumatic. My mother and father both lost one of their parents when they were 16 years old to sudden death. And then 3 years later, my father's only sibling died tragically in an accident as well on the river, Ohio River. And by that time, my parents were in college and they were dating. They then subsequently got married. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, died of a heart attack. And then I was born, and then my father's father died in a car accident. So they weren't just deaths, they were sudden deaths. And that really left my parents in their mid-20s with three children and you know, kind of assaulted by death, really, if you can say that. And the grief was not really identified. I mean, in other words, when I was trying to get into this story and figure out how to go deeper, I asked the question, where did the hole come from in our family that alcohol was trying to fill? And that led me to the grief and the ghosts.
In your early years, your dad was really having a real tough problem with alcohol, which
definitely
infected the family. Tell us about that.
Well, just jumping from really where I was, he never dealt very well. He couldn't deal. He was just assaulted, like I said, with the deaths. But we lived in a country club culture where drinking was... I didn't know any adults when I was a kid who didn't drink. I mean, I just thought that was part of what you did when you were growing up. Everybody drank, but not everybody drank alcoholically. And this was in the 60s and 70s, so alcoholism was a taboo word that was not spoken in the East End of Louisville anyway. So he really struggled, and the way that it happened was he couldn't keep jobs. So it really hit our family financially. Fortunately, he, you know, began to stay away from the house. When I say fortunately, because as it progressed, he was very mean and unhappy and irritable. And but he tended to hide and stay away from the family.
I don't want to put words in your mouth,
no.
But the story, as you talk about the ghost, I understand better the maybe the causal relationship between your dad's conduct or his situation mm-hmm. and his loss of his father and his brother. I mean, because he was, how am I going to describe this? Was he was dependent on them for support and reinforcement and lost that. And
completely. He was, I mean, he was 16. He's younger. His brother was 7 years older than him. And my father had an argument with his mother the night before, and then the next day she was in the hospital and he didn't see her again, and she died of a cerebral hemorrhage really pretty abruptly. And in his words, he said life kind of went to hell in a handbasket after that. So it was these three men living in the house. Well, then his older brother got married and had a couple little kids, and then he died too. And that was right around the time my father was supposed to be going to college, or kind of had, and he was really lost. And he describes that.
Yeah, it's the other interesting feature of this is that your family was on the edge of either sort of moving towards the middle class and lower middle class, but living on the edge of upper class kind of living and
exactly.
country club kind of living.
Mm-hmm.
And your grandfather, your father's father, had been successful and was.
They were a prominent family in Louisville. He was a politician. He was an alderman. He'd really a civic leader, well-known name in town. And my mother came from a well-to-do family also. And so we were just like any other young family at the country club.
All the family connections to move in Louisville social circles at a high level, but because of your father's incapacity, I guess is the right word, he couldn't make enough money to support that, and that must have been a terrible kind of thing for you all as a family to
there was
with.
A lot of well there it was, but I tell you what else was kind of interesting. We were swimmers, and intense swimming. We swam for Lakeside, which is a powerhouse.
Lakeside is sort of the open ended, not
yes,
the
not the country
this
club.
This is real competitive swimming.
We started swimming in the summers at the country club and continued during the summers. But the summer leagues there allow AAU swimmers, AAU being like Olympic bound kind of, or hopefuls. And so we swam at Lakeside, and. So we were very much in. So what happened was we were such good swimmers that the country club wanted us to stay on the team, even after my parents had decided they had to get out because we were behind in the dues. And the country club wanted to win the big meet, and so they wanted all three of us to.
Kind of the ringers.
Yeah,
so
we were. And you know, and it sounds kind of absurd now, but at the time, there was a lot of shame involved with that.
Right.
You know, I mean, we knew we couldn't get anything at the snack bar, or, you know, and here we're wearing these preppy clothes like everybody, and we look like we fit in, and we're, you know, projecting the image, but we're falling apart on the inside. Which we didn't know we really were, because when you're in an alcoholic family, as a kid, you don't know any different. You don't know. I mean, there's just unpredictability, and you just do what you're, you know, kind of taught to do, and that was keep moving and keep looking like you belong.
Well, you were very, I guess, frank is the right word to use, but you said. During this time that your dad was caught up in alcoholism and anger,
yes,
that you hated him.
I did. I did. I just there was this amazing. I can use the term dynamic now. I didn't know that term then, but just my mother would complain about him, and yet she'd be working so hard, making dinner, taking it, you know, serving dinner, very much the traditional, I guess, out of the 50s and into the 60s. And it just was, I just couldn't stand it. And he would not be, he wasn't fair. Like, he would all of a sudden yell at us or act really like he was a Marine and like we were supposed to respect him, but he was not behaving respectfully, I should say it that way. And so I really did. I saw him as the problem in our family. He was the cause of the problems. And when he wasn't around, everything was better and easier. The thing is, he saw himself as a problem too. I mean, later I learned, you know, he was so full of guilt and really pain, but it came out as anger.
Well, how did your mama deal with this?
She is amazing. She worked very hard. Well, she had her codependency, to use jargon, but really what that meant was she planned everything ahead. You know, we were on different carpool schedules. She went to work as a teacher because we needed the money. So we lived on her $10,000 teacher salary while we were still going to the country club. It's just insane. And but she was really determined to, and she loves my father, and she was determined to hold our family together and did not want to have to separate from him. However, she went back to graduate school to become a principal. It took her 10 years to get her graduate degree. She worked three jobs, and then it finally came to a head.
Well, I'm visiting with Catherine McCall about her new book, a memoir called Lifeguarding, a memoir of secret swimming and the South, and she and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Catherine McCall. Catherine is a psychiatrist in Wilmington. She's the author of Lifeguarding, a memoir of secrets, swimming, and the South. And it's about you and your family. We've been talking mostly about your family, and I'd like to continue that for a minute because the resolution of one feature of your family's problem was a surprise to me as it happened, as your mama kind of took charge of things and fixed it, I guess, temporarily, or fixed it in a way. Tell us how your mom brought your daddy around.
Well,
is that a fair? Or tell us the story.
Okay, you're talking about the first breaking point of the family.
Yes, I'm talking. Mm-hmm. To be specific, your dad encountered all kinds of problems. Couldn't keep a job.
Right.
Your mama contemplated divorce.
Right.
Couldn't deal with that in her own mind, but finally, just totally lost patience with your dad, and that and was able to bring that to a resolution where.
Well, she changed what she did, okay, and that's so. What happened was, we got home and the phone rang. We got home on a Friday afternoon, and the phone rang. My mom answered the phone, and it was my father's boss who said, "I just wanted to call you and tell you that we had to let Kurt go today." And she explained that he was drinking on the job. He was selling real estate or something. I don't know what he was doing. And so this particular time, unlike any other time, because she'd had calls like that before. And she would, you know, hang up and start yelling or be upset or whatever. This time, she just hung up the phone and she went into the dining room and she just stood there and looked up and her eyes were closed and I didn't know what she was doing. What she was doing was she was praying. And when my father came home, of course, my brother and I were in the living room watching. You know, he's here. She went outside and met him in the front yard. And he said, "You won't believe what happened today. They fired everybody." And she just said, "Kurt, we love you, but we can't carry you anymore." And that was her.
And y'all were eavesdropping on this.
Yes. Kurt, my brother and I were standing on the porch because I mean, the way I write it in the book, and it's really true, I really thought, this is it. This is it. My parents are going to get a divorce. And this was in 1974, the fall of 74 or 75. And he just stood there. So that was new for her. They'd gone round and round and round before about, you know, he would promise it would get better, and it would get better, seemed to get better. That's the way alcoholism works, you know? But it never got better. It never changed. And this time, this was different, because she said, we can't carry anymore. And then they said something that I couldn't hear. They weren't yelling. And the next thing I knew, she was coming in the house, and he was going to get cigarettes in his car, and he was coming in the house. And she said, y'all go in and watch TV. We've got to do some talking. And what happened was they called someone who they knew who was an alcoholic who didn't drink anymore. And my father wanted to talk. He called him. He called him, which was unusual. My mom would have always called people and all that kind of stuff. So he took that action. So her basically saying in a nutshell, I'm not going around again. I'm not doing it anymore. She changed, and he was ready. He changed.
This was a life-changing moment, I guess, for him. This is an honest question. Was it a dramatic change in your family's experience, or was this just one little minor improvement, and their family continued to have secrets and controversies and tensions?
No. This was a dramatic change in the way our family felt and functioned inside the house. Now, what happened was that my father started to figure out how to not drink, and he talked with people who helped him, and so then what started happening, and I mean it took a few months, but the yelling stopped. The you know, him all of a sudden jumping out of the chair and telling us to go do something stopped. And then by the time I was in the next spring, and I remember that because my birthday's in March, he was engaging me in conversations about life and God and, just spiritual sorts of things. And I write this in the book because I say it's kind of odd it's interesting that my dad and I were 15 at the same time asking those big universal questions, because he started drinking when he was 15.
And so he'd just been out of touch in some respect.
And it was 40.
And did you feel like your father was coming to terms also in growing up with the loss of his sibling and his parents?
Eventually. I mean, the first was just simply changing, not drinking, and then his mood improved. Now, it didn't necessarily improve their marriage right away, because my mom, she wasn't interested in his philosophizing. Which is why he and I think had conversations.
Now I missed this. Tell me about this. I'm sorry.
Here she's been, for 10, 15 years. Oh, especially the final 6 or 7 years were very hard, and it was getting harder. So here she'd been working, three jobs and, holding the whole family together. Well, now he's kind of finding himself and wanting to share. And she was like, forget it, buddy. No, I didn't go into all that because that's their marriage, yeah.
Well, this is not all there is to it by any means. One of the subtitles and a very important feature of your book is swimming.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned about your very high intensity, and you and your sister, and I guess maybe your brother a little bit too, mm-hmm. Happened to be great.
We were good swimmers, definitely. But we were particularly stars on the country club team because anybody that swam year round was going to be a lot better than anybody who swam, seasonally. But Kurt won state championship. I won state championship. We certainly were on championship relays.
Is this, it was an important feature of your life. Is it an important feature of the story?
Swimming?
It weaves in and out, but is the swimming, how does the swimming fit into the secrets that your family had and the family tension?
Well,
or is it just sort of a side story?
No. I think swimming was my mother, and swimming were the two things that saved our family. And swimming did that by structuring us I mean, we were always on a schedule, which I think was actually really useful because the routine helped bring some sanity to the unpredictability. It gave us all an opportunity to have some mastery and some self-esteem and some, you know, attention. And then for me, the swimming, it does show how we always were connected. We all were lifeguards and literally lifeguards as well as guardians of each other's lives.
Yeah. Oh, I see this now. I mean, and you use the life-saving manuals, words of advice and instruction as sort of introductions.
Right.
But I see this now that swimming was y'all's lifesaver in some respects.
Yes.
And that it rescued you from deep water or something like that. Well, before I start philosophizing, let's take a break. And we come back, we'll talk more about your memoir.
Okay.
This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Catherine McCall about her memoir, Lifeguarding. We'll be right back. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Catherine McCall, author of Lifeguarding, and it's a memoir you've talked about your family and about you. And you've talked about, I love the idea that your dad and you were 15 at the same time, and you were getting closer because you could talk about things. But the other point, I mean, another poignant part of the book was what was beginning to happen to you.
Yes.
As you moved into your teenage years, it was puzzling, and you talk about it so frankly and warmly and honestly. Tell us about this and how it first hit you, and tell us that story.
All right. Well, I was very much trying to be a good, perfect kid and not cause any problems. And I was taking a nap one day in between swim practice, and I woke up and I had this vision of myself kissing a girl. And I just put my arm...
Is this your fifth... How old are you? 15?
I was probably about 13.
About
maybe.
13,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And so the time when the chemicals start going in your body and you think about kids... Well,
right,
girls
right.
thinking
I mean, yeah,
about
I was
kissing
yeah, right,
boys.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you know, the majority of the population anyway. And... So that image came into my mind, and I just threw my arm over my face, and a huge no echoed all through me on the inside. And it really was like pushing that down, because that was not going to be okay, which is amazing in a way if you think about it, how I had so internalized that, but I did. I did. I absolutely, to be that way, I'm in quotations here, or strange
so
or weird. At that time, I didn't even know what the word homosexuality meant. I had never heard it, but I had heard, you know, those intonations and negative comments, with words like fags or whatever,
yeah.
you know.
It was early 70s, early 1970s.
60s and 70s,
yeah.
early 70s. In Louisville, in the South, east end of Louisville. And and then I pushed that down. And it became, DG, it became more a sense of something wrong with me.
Well, let me ask you this. This was not quite clear to me in the book, although you talked about your experiences with boys.
Uh-huh.
But did you have dreams like that with boys acting too, or were they just completely out of the picture? Were there some mixing up of this?
You just go right ahead and ask me anything. That's just fine.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, that's
You're
what
have to
I put it
anything.
Out there. That's right. No, I did not have dreams like that about boys. And yet, I knew I was supposed to. And boys were interested in me, and I. You know, went out on dates and stuff like that, but nothing like so many girls who get quote unquote boy crazy.
Right. The age, the 13, 14, when teenage girls often are just sort of ridiculous about all of this. But now this is, I'm asking you kind of to step aside for a moment and help me as a professional, because it's my impression, you know, as an older man now who knows, never having gone through any of this as a young woman, but that young women, heterosexual or homosexual, often have these little crushes on each other as teenagers. And then they turn out to be totally heterosexual and interested in boys, too. But they love their girlfriends, hold hands, maybe even want to kiss them. But it's not that kind of thing that you're describing. Or maybe it could have been. I mean,
No, actually, I don't think it is that the kind of thing I'm describing. It's for the most part. I think that girls that age in particular, they share identities. They kind of join identities almost. And that can cross into physical, you know, cuddling in bed or holding hands or just, you know, it's like they're not a whole people. They're like pieces of people and they join together.
Right.
They move in kind of groups and all that. If you were to talk to some of my friends now who, like me, knew when they were younger, they never would have held a girl's hand. Okay?
Too much of a risk of it.
Right. So they already had a sense that they weren't supposed to want to do that. Whereas with, you know, kind of that phase of development that you're talking about with heterosexual women or girls, it's just a natural kind of, you don't think, if you're not thinking about it, then it's probably not, you're not homophobic.
Golly, yeah, okay.
No,
I mean, that's, well, I wish I were prepared to follow this up and ask the questions, but what I think part of the poignancy of your book and as you tell the story now is that you were rejectionist of what you were beginning to believe that you were. And so what was the next time it came up that you can remember?
The next time it came up was when I was in high school, and I developed a crush on a girl in high school and I couldn't have used that word crush. The way I experienced it was I just wanted to know this person. I wanted to be around her and get to know her and spend time with her, which I guess is what a crush is. And I didn't have any sense of where that would stop. I wanted that to keep going wherever that goes. And I think that that's probably a indication of sexuality.
You knew this was sex-based, that this was a
Well, I mean, you know, and you know, again, it's that dangerous waters kind of feeling, and to a certain extent, that's an adolescent experience. You know, it is. But yes, I knew that I wanted to be physically close to her. You know, we played basketball in the backyard, and we would bump into each other, and I would, you know, that would be, you know, compelling.
That's interesting, and again, I'm just so. I just don't have the experience of being a young woman knowing it, but my impression is that just like the kind of the younger teenagers crush, that in the experiences of young women, that even as older teenagers, they establish these kind of gushing friendships or adoring friendships with kind of senior people that are much like what you described in the initial stages of your friendship with this person whom you came to believe that you really loved. Now, you must have to deal with this professionally a lot. Am I way off base?
Well, no. I mean, I think you're talking about, in general, the fluidity of relationships, and particularly with women who, you know, they can become very emotionally attached to one another and do, and get a lot of heterosexual women get a lot of their emotional support from other women and all that. So, you know, in some respects, there's a blurry line for a lot of people. I mean, when you're talking about sexuality, I actually think that, believe it or not, I think Freud had a few things right. And one of the things he said was that there's a continuum, and that we all have bisexual potentiality. But if you think about a continuum, heterosexual on one side, homosexual on the other, bisexual somewhere in the middle, you know, I am someone that is more on one end of that spectrum. Why, you know, that's the million-dollar question, but I know that that is the way I am put together, and I believe that that's the way I came into this world. Other people, they might be someplace different.
Somewhere
on that continuum.
Some of us are, probably none of us are at the
all the way at the end.
Ends,
exactly.
Absolute ends, but some of us are pushed closer to the end of either homosexuality or heterosexuality, and that others. The closer you are to the middle, now this might be heresy. I mean, the closer you are to the middle, the more comfortable you might be with more kind of physical expressions of your affection or your admiration than you might be if you were at the far end.
I think that's a fair observation. I think that that's a really insightful one.
Well, these things that you described so far really didn't cause you a lot of trouble. Your mother began to worry a little bit about you with some of these deep friendships with other women, but not real serious problems.
Well, here's a great example of how denial was operational in our family even after my father got sober. And that is that my friend in high school I was telling you about, or we were talking about, you know, okay, here's my denial. I thought she could call me late at night and nobody would hear the phone ring in my house. So that was one thing. And my mother picked up the phone and listened in on the conversation. And we, you know, we were just talking, I guess, like you do when you're teenagers about, oh, it's wonderful to talk to you and, you know, your voice, and da-da-da, that kind of stuff. It wasn't anything like, you know, X-rated. However, the next day when I came home from work, my mother, and this scene's in the book, my mother was very upset and nervous and lit a cigarette, and she's pacing around the kitchen, and she just confronted me about that conversation, but more from the standpoint of that girl has feelings for you. She talks to you like a boyfriend would talk to a girlfriend. That was exact words that she said, and I completely, you know, played it cool and said, oh, no, I minimized all that. And the way the denial came in was that was my denial. There was no way with my, I mean, she was so upset if I had said, oh, no, I feel the same way. There was just, that was out of my realm of possibility because I was afraid that she would not be able to stand that. And then we never talked about that again. Okay? For many, many years. That conversation, that is denial.
Well, there's lots more to talk about in your book. I want to take a break and then come back, and if you will, describe how you finally did get around to telling your mama.
Sure.
And I'm talking to Catherine McCall about her memoir, Lifeguarding, a memoir of secret swimming in the South. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Catherine McCall, who's a psychiatrist in Wilmington, who's written a memoir called Lifeguarding, and a subtitled A Memoir of Secret Swimming in the South, and a memoir about our family that we've talked about. And much of the guts of it is the memoir of your learning about and then finally acknowledging and telling your family about your homosexuality.
Right.
And again, for me, it's just both terrible and also very poignant and very powerful, your story of how you happened to tell your family about this and how they dealt with it. And I wonder if you'd share some of that with us.
Well, I was in medical school and in Atlanta and began to break down my own denial for myself. And what I did was I stopped being so overtly lying. I stopped lying.
Stop making it a secret among your colleagues, at least.
And so even in conversations over the phone with my mother, especially, what'd you do this weekend? Well, I went out with my friends. Do any boys go along? No, Mom, I enjoy being with my friends, that kind of thing. So then what happened was the phone rang one day, and long distance, it was my mom calling from Kentucky, and we were talking about something. And then she said, point blank, Kathy, are you gay? And I knew that this was the moment.
But not your choice of
no, I didn't go declare anything. Heavens, no, no. No, it was really awkward. It was hard.
Well, what did you tell her?
I said, if you're asking if I'm in a relationship with a woman, the answer is yes. Because even at that point, I would not be able to say, yes, I am gay. Okay?
I missed it.
I was gay, but right, I wouldn't have been able to own it.
So in your mind, even if you were deceiving yourself, you were saying, I might be involved with a woman now, but I'm not necessarily gay.
I was trying to be true. I was trying to speak what I knew to be true. And that was what was true. I don't know how else to say it.
Well, gosh, I hate to hurry you along because we're running out of time. And this is really just such an important story of what happened next with your family.
Okay, my mom got really upset. She said, I'm not telling anybody. And then, like, within 12 hours, she had called back and had told my brother and sister. And then I didn't talk to anybody in my family, which was unusual. And it felt like 2 years, but it was really a few weeks. And my sister called. And the first thing she said was, don't cut us off. And I said, don't cut you off. So my sister and I talked about this. She was so loving and wonderful.
Almost surprising you because you didn't...
Surprising me. She had friends in college that were gay. We'd never had a conversation about any of this. And she said, oh, it makes you more you. That was her reaction, which is amazing. So she helped me plan coming back to Louisville, and we had a family meeting with the five of us. And that's how the book ends.
Well, there's a lot of conversation because your family moves towards accepting you, but in spurts and slow and differently with different people. I'm more sympathetic with your father at this point, who asked you, oh, this almost made me cry. I mean, he says, I can't remember the exact words, but he says, I was such a bad daddy. I drove you into this, didn't I?
Right. This was my fault.
I have to confess, I was thinking the same thing as he was such a bad daddy in the early part of the book. This is what's, you know, she's reacting against this bad modeling of male-female. And he's almost in tears, I guess, asking you about this. Mm-hmm. And what would you tell him?
I said, it has nothing to do with you, that you did not make me this way, that I was born this way, and that it's nothing you did or didn't do to make me be gay. You did not cause this. I said that to him. And he understands that now.
Let me ask you this. You know, we talked about the continuum. That some people are on either side and some people are on the middle. And you're a professional. I mean, you have to deal with this kind of stuff all the time. But if you're in the middle on the continuum, it is possible that an environmental experience could push you one way or another, isn't it?
I think that people can find... they can be harmed or traumatized in relationships, and they can be enhanced or find safer relationships. So to answer your question, yes, I do think that it's not unusual for people to have been really traumatized. Although, I do think that sexuality is very strong. I think genetically it's very strong. I think that there are fewer people in the middle. In this particular continuum, okay?
So it's not a bell-shaped curve, it's a reverse bell-shaped curve.
I would think it's a reverse bell shape. Yes, so I think it has some impact, but I don't think it has a lot. I really don't.
Now, did your dad accept this? Did your dad believe this now?
Yes, definitely. And he's been able to help other parents, particularly even just as this book is coming out. Parents have come to my parents and talked with them about one of their kids being gay, and they've never talked much about it. And
Let me ask you. God, we're coming to the end. So many questions to ask you, but how does your dad deal with your description in the early part of the book of your hating him as a...
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that, DG, because when I was going to write this book, I told my parents, I'm going to write the story of our family. And he said, if you tell it, you got to tell it straight. No glossing over the hard stuff.
Did he really mean that?
Oh yeah, my dad's a Marine. He's but now he's been sober 30 years. Mm. He's talked to a lot of people and helped a lot of people, and he's a very marvelous person. So he meant it. He's an honest man.
Well, now we just got a second or two left. But are you now? You're a professional. You've now written a book. It's moving along.
Yes.
We think it's getting traction.
Uh-huh.
You want to write some more?
Definitely.
And you're
I love
fiction,
writing.
Or are you
gonna? Well,
we just have
both.
To wait and see.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I've asked the question, not giving you time to answer because time's out.
Okay,
that's the rule. I've been talking to Catherine McCall about her memoir, Lifeguarding, a memoir of secret swimming in the South. Thanks to you, Catherine, and thanks to all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time
tomorrow. Thank you.